Other thing is, please state your name at the beginning of your argument.
May it please the court. My name is Liz McCully, and I, along with my partner, Tom Stewart, represent the plaintiffs in this case. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please. This is a Fifth Amendment takings case.
Just so you know, you have to keep track of your time, Ms. McCully.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The determination of the defendant's liability for a taking will be decided by the Court of Federal Claims and not by this court. However, in order to assist Judge Horn in her decision regarding the defendant's liability, she has requested this court's guidance on the centerline presumption or highway presumption under Colorado law. The question is not novel in the majority of jurisdictions. However, it is a question of first impression for this court. To paraphrase Judge Horn's question, the only issue before this court is, if a railroad abandons its easement, is it presumed that the adjacent landowners take fee title to the centerline of the railroad right-of-way? The answer to that question is yes. Under Colorado's well-settled highway presumption, or otherwise known as the centerline presumption, in the majority of jurisdictions across this country, Colorado has clearly adopted the centerline presumption, as well as the policies and reasonings behind that presumption. There is simply no justification to treat an abandoned strip that was formerly used as a street and an abandoned strip that was formerly used as a railroad right-of-way any different. The reasons for the rule in one case apply equally in the other. In order to, even though it's not determinative on this issue of the centerline presumption, plaintiffs thought we would give a brief background of the Trails Act takings and jurisprudence, as well as the plaintiffs in this case. This case involves 75 Colorado landowners that own land adjoining a former railroad corridor. These 75 plaintiffs account for 85 or 90% of all the plaintiffs or all the landowners along this abandoned line. This is an opt-in class. It's very different than an opt-out class in what we normally see in the federal jurisdictions. These landowners have to affirmatively opt in to assert their right. And here, what that means is there's no absent class member out there that's challenging these landowners' title. The few who didn't opt in simply waive their right to just compensation under the Fifth Amendment. The Trails Act, plaintiffs allege that the defendant is liable for a Fifth Amendment taking of their reversionary interest in their land due to implementation of the Trails Act. The parties have stipulated that the railroad only held an easement for the construction, operation, and maintenance of a railroad, which plaintiffs contend is clearly an easement limited to railroad purposes. When a railroad wants to abandon the line, they have to petition the Surface and Transportation Board and request abandonment. Upon a request of a third party or the railroad, the STB can issue what's called a Notice of Interim Trail Use. And what that does is it blocks the landowner's reversionary interest in their land from vesting. And then when a trail use agreement is reached between the railroad and the trail user, that permanent block is, or the blocking of their vested, or the blocking of their property interest is permanently blocked, and federal jurisdiction is maintained over that railroad right-of-way.
Well, there's an important federal interest in that, right? Would you just explain that as to keep railroad lines, right, for future for future use?
Yes, and actually, the courts of federal claims and all the Trails Act jurisprudence talk about rail banking, and rail banking is not—it's not a vested future interest. It's a—it's when the railroad line interim trail use and rail banking go hand in hand. You have to have them both together under the Trails Act. And so what happens is a trail user says, we're going to use it for interim trail use, but they have to agree that if the federal government ever wants to come back in and reactivate that rail line, that they can do it. And so it's a provision that basically preserves federal jurisdiction over that rail line, rail banking. In this case, the NICHI was issued on April 6, 2004, and that's when these landowners' reversionary interest was blocked from vesting. The trail user did come in, or the trail user and the railroad reached an agreement, and so the line is permanently rail banked. The Federal Circuit set forth the standard in Trails Act takings cases and has repeatedly affirmed that liability standard. And there are really three questions that you to be asked and to be answered. The first question is, who owns the strip of land involved. Specifically, did the railroad acquire only easements, or did it obtain fee simple estates? That's the first question under the Federal Circuit Directive that must be asked. Plaintiffs don't have the burden to show they own the underlying fee through chains of title. They've already established by stipulation that the railroad held an easement, so that question's been answered here. The second question is, if the easement is limited to railroad purposes, is Troy use outside the scope of that easement? And if so, a takings occurs. And the third question, which is the second way a takings can occur, is if the easement is an unlimited easement and if the railroad abandons it prior to issuance of the need to, then a taking occurs when the need to is issued, because then it takes the landowner's reversionary interest again. Our firm represents thousands of landowners across this country in approximately 40 Trails Act takings cases. We're very familiar with the jurisprudence as well as the defendant's arguments attempting to circumvent the Federal Circuit's directive. This exact argument has been made several times in the Court of Federal Claims involving cases in various states. It's interesting to note that there's a Colorado Trails Act takings case, and it's LMA Phillips. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but LMA Phillips involved a abandoned rail line, and that was decided in 2009. Now, the defendant did not challenge the centerline presumption in that Colorado case. Why not? Because this is their new argument du jour. They've been making it for about the last year, year and a half, and like I said, they argue that plaintiffs don't have standing, and that has been rejected every time it's been made in the Court of Federal Claims under various state laws. So why are we here? Although other courts rarely certify questions to state Supreme Courts, Judge Horn is, she routinely certifies questions if there's no case directly on point. So, but just as the justices have done in the Court of Federal Claims, plaintiffs believe that this court should reject the defendant's argument here as well. The defendant does not argue that they own the underlying fee. They don't argue that the railroad owns the underlying fee. They agree that landowners own the underlying fee in that railroad right-of-way. The history behind the centerline presumption, the policies and reasoning regarding that presumption is the majority rule and is adopted and accepted in Colorado as well. And basically, to identify the ownership in a right-of-way easement, you have to start somewhere. And based on public policy and the policy adopted by the Colorado courts, the place to start is a centerline presumption, which in turn is subject to rebuttal. The public policy behind the strip and, or behind the centerline presumption can be found in the longstanding strip and gore doctrine, which is applied almost by almost every state to promote the efficient ownership in land. The longstanding doctrine was discussed in 1885 in Payne versus Consumer Forwarding and Storage. That was a case that was authored by Justice Taft. And the Payne Court discussed the policy and reasonings behind the strip and gore doctrine, and through an extensive analysis and use of analogies, held that the rule of boundaries along running streams should apply to boundaries along highways. The reasons for the rule in one case apply equally to the other. In 1961, this court looked to the Payne decision when it affirmed Colorado's adherence to the centerline presumption. This court in Morrissey in 1961, quoting Payne, said the evils resulting from the retention in remote dedicators in the fee in gores and strips have led courts to include the fee of such gores and strips in the deeds of abutting lots. The main justification for the centerline presumption or the strip and gore doctrine is the policies behind it and reasoning. Most importantly is it honors a grantor's most likely true intent, because rarely would a grantor find a way to devote a remote, narrow strip of land for some kind of productive use. It promotes efficient use of land by keeping the title of both parts unified. It is against public policy to leave long, narrow strips in a grantor, because public policy avoids isolated ownership in narrow strips. It also prevents the restraint on marketability of title and an unnecessary clouding of title. And it avoids unnecessary and vexatious litigation. It is clear that Colorado adopts the centerline presumption, including the reasonings and policies behind it. In 1898, the Olin Court, the Colorado Supreme Court, said that a parcel of land abutted by a street carries title to the centerline of the street. In Oberlin Machine in 1902, the Colorado Supreme Court said that a parcel of land abutting a highway carries title to the centerline of that highway. In 1926, in the Skerritt Court, they held that a land abutting a road carried title to the center line of the road.
But you called it a reversionary interest, though. It sounds to me like it's got to revert to a former title, and in a public land state like Colorado, where these railroads were built, and sometimes it got every other section, as you know, to build them. There was only land in the federal government. The homesteaders then got land. Now, how do we square this notion you have that the Colorado Constitution, in effect, granted somebody who may not have conveyed any land for the easement or the right-of-way, it may have come out of the public domain. How does that square with the history and background of our state? And is it a reversion to a prior legal interest, and doesn't it have to be shown at some point?
Your Honor, reversionary interest is a short term, or the shortcut that the Federal Circuit uses. It's not really truly a reversionary interest, because basically when a landowner owns the land, when a landowner grants the railroad, in this case the landowners all granted the railroad easements, and the defendant has stipulated to that. We don't have any land grant, like you're talking about checkerboard land grants. This is not a land grant case. This is nothing like the Hinojos case. So we've stipulated that these landowners own land adjacent to the railroad right-of-way, and they were it was given by specific deeds, and so the reverse.
But the deeds are lost. What's
no? We have the deeds. The defendant has agreed and stipulated that all of the deeds conveyed by the predecessors in interest conveyed the railroad only an easement for the construction, operation, and maintenance of a railroad. So when a railroad stops using that line for the limited easement, per limited use that it was given, then the easement simply extinguishes. It doesn't really revert back to the landowners. It just extinguishes, and the landowner would have their land unencumbered by any easement.
Could I ask you a question about the stipulation? I understood the government's argument, at least a sort of an alternate argument, to be that the rule itself was only the centerline rule, only applied if the grantor really had an interest that he retained that he could convey, if I'm saying that right. Do you disagree with that, or are you just saying in your case that's been stipulated away or can be proved?
Well, I think that the centerline presumption is exactly the place to start. And so what you're asking is if a title dispute would ensue, like two landowners on either side, if they would have a title dispute, that would be evidence that they would use to rebut that centerline presumption. So our position is you start first with the centerline presumption, and then if an adjacent or there's a title dispute, then that party would have the burden to show the superiority in their title over the defendant's title, which can be done. I mean, that's what it's just a presumption. It's not holding that the landowner absolutely owns to the center line of the railroad right-of-way.
So at least in terms of the presumptions, you are disagreeing with the government's articulation of the rule.
I do. I believe that under the center line presumption and the majority rule in the jurisdictions, that's exactly what it says. That's what the center line presumption is meant to do, is to avoid litigation that's unnecessary, et cetera. And so you start there, and then any party wishing to provide evidence to rebut that presumption, by all means, that you can under whatever state law. So Colorado statute.
Mr. Colley, what about it doesn't seem to be it's in the stipulated facts. Government points out that the scope of the easement, they don't quite agree with your discussion. How are we supposed to look at that?
Well, that's not really an issue for this court, actually. That'll be decided by Judge Horn, because that goes to the defendant's liability. It's irrelevant regarding the question before this court. The question is, if a railroad abandons an easement, so you have to presume that it's an easement and it's abandoned, what do the landowners take to the center line of that railroad? Is it presumed that they own fee title to the center line, which is still subject to rebuttal? The scope of the easement, I don't think, is an issue that I will tell you, under Colorado law, we absolutely believe that the easement, the scope of this easement is exceeded, and that trail use is not within a railroad purposes easement. The plaintiffs believe there's just no justification under the policy and reasoning of the centerline presumption to treat a railroad right-of-way any different than a street. In fact, there's three sources of Colorado law that support plaintiffs' position: common law, statutory law, and the Constitution. I've mentioned the common law, where we have the Supreme Court continually and repeatedly affirming the policies and reasoning behind the centerline presumption. And there's also cases that call the railroad a road in Colorado. That is the Atchison versus Denver, 110 U.S. 667. That was a Colorado Supreme Court case that went to the Supreme Court. Under Colorado statutes, the second source, the statutes are very clear. Colorado defines a right-of-way under Chapter 12, Article 4, Section 12440. A right-of-way means a strip of land that was granted through an easement or other mechanism for transportation purposes, such as a roadway or a highway. Colorado defines a roadway under 43.2.301. A roadway includes any platted or designated public street, alley, land, parkway, avenue, road, or other public way. Colorado identifies a railroad right-of-way as a road under 40.20.103. Any railroad company having located its line of road. The Colorado statutes do not make any distinction between a street road and a railroad road, and there shouldn't be any distinction here. Under the Colorado Constitution, the third source, again, the Colorado Constitution under Article 15, Section 4 states all roadways shall be public highways. It also says that every railroad shall have the right with its road. So again, we have the Constitution identifying railroad right-of-ways as highways and roads. Therefore, under the plain meaning of the words of the Colorado Constitution and statutes, a railroad right-of-way is a road. It is a highway. It is a right-of-way. It is indistinguishable from another right-of-way, including a street or a highway. The highway presumption applies to railroad rights-of-way just like it applies to any other right-of-way. The reasons for the rule apply equally in one case as another. A fourth source is...
That's a common law rule on our... I mean, the Constitution doesn't quite define it like that, right? I mean, is it left up to statute and case law to have the centerline presumption? I mean, that doesn't appear in the Constitution, right?
No, the centerline presumption does not appear in the Constitution. But I would say the argument I am making is that the Colorado Constitution clearly identifies a railroad as a public highway and a road, and so there's no distinction.
Okay, so give us the rest of the derivation. How does the centerline presumption arise in Colorado law?
Okay. Well, the centerline presumption arises under Colorado law when a landowner has a parcel of land that is abutting a road or a highway. It is presumed that they take title to the centerline of that highway or road upon abandonment.
But we've never had a case involving railroad.
Not involving a railroad, Your Honor. There are many cases, and you know, I wonder about that. There's a few jurisdictions that don't, and when I spoke with people in Colorado, attorneys, it's because people just assume that the centerline presumption applies. When a railroad abandons the land, you know, and we do have abandonments, outright abandonments of railroad rights of way all over the country. And when that happens, they take center to the centerline of the railroad right of way, just, you know. And there's also a statute under Colorado that allows, you know, landowners to agree as to boundary lines and things like that. So despite all this overwhelming precedential law and pronouncements from the courts of Colorado, including the Colorado statutes, the defendant just simply states that Hinojos versus Lohman does not provide evidence of the centerline presumption. And I would like to tell this court that although Hinojos did not apply the centerline presumption, that was based on specific and limited circumstances of that case. It was an 1875 land grant case. And so Hinojos, the parties had agreed that a specific statute applied to that case. That statute was 43 U.S.C. Section 912. Section 912 held the plaintiff to a higher burden of proof. The plaintiff had to provide through chains of title pursuant to that statute, title all the way back to the United States. And so it was also a title dispute. So the plaintiff had to provide evidence of the superiority of their title instead of relying on the weakness of the defendant's title. This case is not an 1875 land grant case, and we certainly don't agree that Section 912 applies. This is not a title dispute. The defendant is not even a potential title holder in this case. Therefore, we believe that the Hinojos case, and Hinojos also did go through the centerline presumption, and they talked about several cases from other state courts that went through the policies and reasoning behind the centerline presumption applying to railroad rights of way. And Hinojos said this. They talked about the policies and reasonings. It says, we agree with this reasoning. It is generally illogical to assume that a grantor of a tract that includes a railroad right-of-way intends to retain the serving estate underlying the railroad right-of-way while parting with the remainder tract. The Hinojos Court absolutely agreed with and applied the centerline presumption, but in that case, it was held a different way because of the specific statute they agreed applied. Other cases and arguments made by the defendant actually support plaintiff's position. The defendant said this: although most state Supreme Courts to have considered the issue have held the centerline rule does not apply to railroad rights-of-way, those courts have not agreed on the justification for extending the rule. The primary reason given by some courts is the avoidance of vexatious litigation as a matter of policy because the existence of narrow strips of land distinct in ownership from the adjoining territory would create a prolific source of litigation. Exactly. To avoid this exact vexatious litigation, when the defendant's not even a potential title holder. The Smith Court, cited by the defendant, went on to say, the fact that the origin of these narrow parcels lies in a former highway or public use rather than a railroad makes no difference.
What about their position that that's not the purpose of the railroad? You know, it didn't actually benefit adjacent landowners.
I think that if you would ask anybody in Weld County, Colorado, Colorado, who owns a sugar beet farm, and this was a sugar beet train, they would disagree with that. Of course, railroads, benefit the landowners. We see it in Iowa, the corn growers. You know, I mean, railroads definitely benefit landowners, and I don't believe that the defendant provides any basis or authority saying that they don't benefit the adjacent land.
What about their position that the consideration hasn't been paid for?
And that's ridiculous again, because consideration in the original grantor, they got consideration. Some of the consideration is for the, you know, running of trains over their land. So I don't really understand when they're saying they didn't get consideration for it. The only way you would know if they didn't get consideration for it or give consideration would be a chain of title, which, again, the centerline presumption applies. The plaintiffs get a benefit of that centerline presumption, and it's up to the defendant or some other person challenging the title to provide evidence of some, you know, dispute. If the court were to agree with the defendant, vexatious litigation would ensue. We saw that, like with the after the Morrissey court, where Colorado had a statute that said if a street is abandoned and then later a landowner sells their parcel of land, they had to include a legal description in the deed to convey the abandoned part of the strip. Well, title disputes ensued. And so in 2005, Colorado legislature completely flipped. And they did exactly what they've done over the last 100 years and apply the centerline presumption, saying now when a person sells their land, if they don't include the abandoned strip in the grant, it is assumed that they included it unless they expressly exclude it. Why? Why would Colorado do that? Because it comports with the grantor's most likely intent, because rarely would a grantor be able to put a strip of land to some productive use. The bottom line is this: the defendant is simply trying to circumvent and avoid paying these Colorado landowners the just compensation they deserve under the Trails Act. There is simply no distinction between a railroad right-of-way and a street road.
Tell me a little bit about that. What does the Trails Act presume in terms of compensation?
Well, the Trails Act, like any Fifth Amendment takings case, if the defendant is held liable, then what we do is usually we work with the government and we hire joint appraisers, and they basically come up with the fair market value of the land. We settle a lot of them, through negotiation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If there's a challenge to the landowner's interest, it is a burden of that party and the government, meaning the government here, to provide rebuttal evidence proving that the landowner does not own the underlying fee in the railroad right-of-way. That's what Justice Firestone said in the Trails Act taken in Indiana. The centerline presumption is a rule that preserves the institute of property ownership. It is a rule that specifically adopted in Colorado to protect property rights of the citizens of Colorado, including the plaintiffs in this case. The centerline presumption honors the grantor's most likely true intent, avoids isolated ownership in land, and is the proper standard to start for identification of the property owners owning land underlying that railroad right-of-way. The plaintiffs in this case benefit from the centerline presumption because an abandoned strip is an abandoned strip. The reason for the rule apply equally in one case as another. Thank you.
Thank you. Government?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Nicholas Damasio on behalf of the United States of America, and may it please the court. I'm happy here to answer whatever questions you may have about the positions that we put forward in our brief, but I've come prepared to primarily discuss three points. The first point that I'd like to discuss is what, as a practical matter, is at issue in the certified question that this court is going to answer. The second issue that I'd like to discuss is whether or not the rationale for the common law rule of conveyance known as the centerline rule justifies applying that rule to railroad rights of way as opposed to ordinary public highways, which this court has not previously had occasion to address. The third point that I'd like to discuss today is an alternative argument that if this court concludes that the centerline rule should apply to railroad rights of way, I'd like to explain why, under the very terms of that rule, merely owning adjacent land is insufficient to claim presumptive title up to the center line of the adjacent right-of-way, but rather, under the terms of the rule itself, as this court's case law has stated, plaintiff must provide evidence that the person who granted them their adjacent land had fee title to the right-of-way property. So turning to my first point, which has to do with the practical implications of this court's decision here. The case underlying the certified question concerns a railroad right-of-way that the Colorado municipalities of Windsor, Severance, and Eaton are managing as a recreational trail. And before they could do so, the United States Surface Transportation Board had to issue what is known as a Notice of Interim Trail Use under the National Trail System Act. Now, whether the United States effected a Fifth Amendment taking of private property by issuing that notice is not at issue in this case. That is a question that will be answered by the Court of Federal Claims. And so we would like to assume, just for the purposes of this argument, that the United States owes compensation for a Fifth Amendment taking. Our concern here is that the rule that this court adopts ensures that the true owner of this right-of-way property ultimately is paid if a taking has occurred. And so in our view, the question for this court is effectively what must a plaintiff show to claim an interest in a railroad right-of-way under Colorado law? And the answer that this court gives to that question will affect how likely it is that the true owner of this right-of-way property gets paid.
Well, Mr. Damasio, I guess you argue that it's not an evidentiary presumption, but it's a rule of conveyance. It appears, at least from looking at the briefings, that clearly the common law rule is that it's a presumption and not a rule of conveyance. So why are you taking, I mean, I understand why you're taking that position as a practical matter, but do you concede that that's the majority common law rule?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. We do not concede that. Under this court's case law, as this court stated in Overland, the centerline rule is, and I quote, one of construction only. This court has never held that the centerline rule is a strict evidentiary presumption that merely because you own property adjacent to a highway, you also own an interest in the highway itself. That is not how virtually any of the case law discusses the centerline rule. In fact, the overwhelming majority of the authority that's been cited to this court, including almost every case that's cited in the plaintiff's brief, discusses the centerline rule as a rule of conveyance, not a strict evidentiary presumption.
And when the word construction is used, that's construction of the conveyance?
That's correct. What the centerline rule is, specifically, is it's a rule of construction that a deed conveying land bordering on a highway presumptively includes title to the center line of that highway, but only if the grantor owns such title.
Right.
That is the way this court has described the center line rule on two occasions, once in Olin, and then again in Overland. So our point here is that
he's playing. Well, just a second. I mean, I'm just reading it. You know, it's an old case, and it's kind of tough to know exactly what they're saying. But it says it may be stated as a general rule that a conveyance of a lot which borders upon a highway presumptively carries the title to the center of the street.
Correct.
That sounds like a rule, a presumption to me.
It is a presumption.
That's not a rule of conveyance.
It's a way of construing a deed so that even if it doesn't expressly mention conveyance of the right-of-way property, the deed is presumed to include the right-of-way property up to the center line, so long as the grantor owns that fee interest. It's a way of construing the deed. And the operation of the presumption is merely to state that the grantor, it's the grantor's obligation to expressly reserve on the face of the deed his interest, his or her interest in the right-of-way property. That is the operation of the presumption. It's not just a strict evidentiary presumption that if you own property adjacent to a right-of-way, you also own the right-of-way property itself. That's not how any of the case law discusses the centerline. And in fact, in virtually every recitation of the centerline rule that's been quoted to your honors, there is that additional caveat at the end, if the grantor owns up to the center line. And so our position here is that it is traditionally the plaintiff's burden of proof to show in these types of property disputes the strength of their own title. So the burden is on the plaintiff to show that, in fact, their grantor had fee title to the right-of-way property.
I'm a little bit concerned about this because, you know, we have these different kinds of interests called a permit, a license, a irrevocable license, and in particular, I'm talking about ditches that were dug across other people's property, right? So there are very valuable rights of ways and easements and licenses granted that have to do with not including in the deed the right-of-way or the easement, you know, as a definite intent. Yet they're conveyed, right? So I guess what I'm asking is, what burden is there really on the U.S. to have to go and show these deeds in rebutting this presumption? Isn't it a good stance to take that, however the right-of-way happened, there was some kind of a fee interest that was being relinquished in some way to allow the railroad to go through, which, you know, obviously benefited commerce and the growth of northeastern Colorado in this particular case? So what's wrong with starting with a presumption and having the U.S. Produce the deeds that show otherwise to achieve the kind of right, correct payment to the correct property owner that you're talking about?
Well, that's simply not the way property law has ever worked in this state or in most states. As I said, the traditional burdens of proof in any kind of a property dispute is that the plaintiff has the burden to show the strength of their own title. And what we're talking about here is that these plaintiffs, in particular, the deeds that they placed into the record, all they showed is that they own the adjacent property. And so it very well may be the case that someone else owns the property underlying the right-of-way. For example, the person that's on the other side of the right-of-way property from one of our plaintiffs in this case, okay? And so, in effect, by allowing a plaintiff to claim an interest in this right-of-way property merely based upon the ownership of the adjacent property, you could effectively be taking property from a person on one side of the right-of-way and giving it to these plaintiffs unless a third party, the defendant, United States, can disprove the plaintiff's interest in that right-of-way property. And that's what I'm saying is not how property law has ever worked. In property disputes, a plaintiff has always borne the burden to show the strength of their own title. They cannot rely upon the weakness of title in someone else. And so all we're saying here is that this court should maintain that traditional burden of proof on the plaintiff to come forward with its chain of title, because that is the best way to ensure that the correct person is paid. If you do it the other way and you allow a plaintiff to claim a presumptive interest based merely on the ownership of the adjacent land, there could be a situation where, because the United States is unable to disprove the plaintiff's interest in that property, we end up paying out one plaintiff. Then later, another plaintiff comes along and actually is able to show through their entire chain of title that they were the 100% fee owner of the right-of-way property there. We have to pay out again. And this is going to come up not only in takings cases, but also in ordinary property disputes between regular landowners. And so, if, in effect, what you'd be doing if you countenance this evidentiary presumption interpretation of the centerline rule, which is unsubstantiated in any of the precedent that's been cited to your honors, you would essentially be shifting the burden to a defendant property owner to produce the plaintiff's chain of title.
Now, Mr. Damasio, can I ask you a question? Don't you have an obligation to give notice to the landowner that you're taking their property?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the context.
Well, you're taking someone's property. Do you not have some obligation to give them notice that you're taking their property? I mean, you're kind of making it seem like there's some unknown person out there. Well, the government is taking their property. Shouldn't the government give them notice that they're taking it?
Well, I think what Your Honor is referring to is the potentially the notice of interim trail use that's issued by the Surface Transportation Board. That is effectively the notice, not that there's a taking, but that's a notice that's issued by the Surface Transportation Board that someone has applied to use this right-of-way as a recreation.
Well, is that served on all the landowners along the right-of-way?
I don't believe that it's served. I don't believe it's served on all landowners along the right-of-way. I think it's published in the Federal Register, and so it's publicly accessible. But I don't believe that it's
noticed by publication.
Yeah, I believe so. I feel there's some concern among your honors about the seeming implication of our argument that we're in effect trying to avoid having to pay out plaintiffs, and that's not what
it does sound a little like that.
That I can understand your feeling that, but that's really not our concern. Again, our concern in this case is to ensure that whatever rule this court adopts identifies the true owner of the right-of-way property. Because it's only that true owner who owns the fee title to the right-of-way that has the reversionary interest that needs to be compensated. And it's important to note that whatever rule this court adopts in this case, whether this court agrees with us that the centerline rule should not apply to railroad rights-of-way because railroad rights-of-way are different than ordinary public highways and stream beds, or whether this court agrees with our position that the plaintiff, in order to invoke that centerline rule, has to come forward with evidence that the plaintiff, that the person who granted the plaintiffs their land, in fact, owned fee title to the right-of-way corridor. Whichever position that this court adopts, these plaintiffs, in front of the Court of Federal Claims, will have an opportunity to make their case.
Give us kind of a majority-minority breakout here among the states.
Your Honor, in terms of our position that railroad rights of way are different, there's only 16 states that have ever considered whether or not the centerline rule should apply to railroad rights of way. Okay. And we acknowledge that the majority of those states have said that the centerline rule should apply to railroad rights of way based on this public policy about not rendering narrow strips of land useless.
Take your best shot at the minority position and why that's cogent public policy.
The actual rationale for the centerline rule is the probable intent of the grantor to convey all of those rights that are appurtenant in the adjacent right-of-way that the buyer expects to be able to use upon purchasing the adjacent property. And so, as this court said in Olin, the buyer pays an increased price for those appurtenant rights, expecting to be able to use them. The most obvious of those would be, for example, the right to be able to use the right-of-way property for the highway for ingress or egress to the adjacent parcel. Or, in the case of a stream bed, the right to be able to use the water, ice, the rocks that are in the stream bed. Now, because the buyer pays that increased price, there's an objective manifestation of both parties' expectation that the buyer is going to be able to use the adjacent property. However, as the Colorado Court of Appeals said in Sinclair, the owner of property that's adjacent to a railroad right-of-way doesn't have any such expectation because the owner of a railroad right-of-way is entitled to entirely exclude the public. A railroad right-of-way remains private property, and so the buyer of adjacent parcel doesn't have any expectation of being able to use a railroad right-of-way that's in their backyard. Moreover, it would defy common sense to think that the ordinary purchaser of property would pay an increased price for a parcel simply because it has a railroad right-of-way running through its backyard. And so our position is that where a railroad right-of-way is not mentioned within the four corners of a deed, where that interest is not mentioned by the grantor, there's simply no reason to presume that either the grantor or the grantee intended that the railroad right-of-way parcel would be included within that grant. And so to apply the centerline presumption to a railroad right-of-way as opposed to an ordinary public highway or a stream bed would essentially be a windfall to the grantee at the expense of the grantor. And so we're urging your honors to hold that railroad rights-of-way are different in that fundamental quality, and so the centerline rule should not apply to railroad rights-of-way. But even if your honors disagree with me, it's still important to understand that merely owning land adjacent to a railroad right-of-way is not sufficient to invoke the rule.
Can I follow up on that just a minute, your question of back to the articulation of the rule?
Sure.
The way you describe it, you know, I can certainly see policy arguments for that, but the question is, if it has existed that way, what does the center line have to do with it? It seems like the rule, as you articulated, is there's a presumption that a grantor intended to grant his interest in property that he owned, whatever interest he had, over which a railroad, or let's say a highway, runs. Mm-hmm. But what does the center line have to do with that? If he has to prove that that the grantor owned that, had an interest in that property in the first place, then if the grantor could show that he owned the entire land, then it would be presumed, wouldn't it, that he intended to convey his rights under the entire road rather than simply halfway? Well, where's the presumption come in about halfway?
The way the center line comes into the rule, I believe, is let's say you have a person who owns land through which a highway is going to be put. And the highway goes through this person's land, and then he conveys the property on one side of the right-of-way to party A, and the property on the other side of the right-of-way to party B, and never mentions what he intends to do with the highway, with the land underneath the highway. That's where the law has, as a common law rule, typically presumed that he intended to convey up to the center line to the people on either side of the right-of-way. And it makes sense in that situation. What we're pointing out here is that because these plaintiffs have not put any proof into the record whatsoever that the original owner of the right-of-way property is in their chain of title, it's entirely possible that this railroad right-of-way was put through one person's property on one side of the right-of-way. And so what the plaintiff's rule would be doing is it would be saying, unless we can disprove their interest in this property, then they get half of that property. And all we're saying is, no, that's not the traditional way property disputes have been handled in this state or any state. Plaintiff has always borne the burden of the burden to put its own chain of title into the record. And I'd like to point out here that this is not a heavy burden.
Okay. I think I appreciate that. Let me just try it one more, but I still fail to see then where a presumption comes in, because it does seem that what you're saying is, if you're making the claim, you have to prove that your grantor owned the land that you claim an interest in now. So what does the half have to do with? If you prove that he owned the land the entire highway went over, then presumably
it's irrelevant.
Where the
presumption is irrelevant.
No, it's not. Where the presumption comes in is once you've shown that the person who originally owned the highway or the right-of-way land is in your chain of title, Even if within every deed along that chain of title, no one ever said, I grant you my interest in that right-of-way. Even if that's completely absent from the entire chain of title, you get half. It's presumed that the grantor grantors down the chain intended to keep conveying that unless there's an explicit reservation on the face of the deeds.
I understand that.
That's the effect of the presumption.
But I don't understand why you said you get half. Isn't your rule you get whatever the grantor owned? It's presumed he intended to convey that to you. If he owned half, you get half. If he owned the whole highway, you get the whole highway.
I don't think that... No, Your Honor. It may be that that someone else can come along and also show that their grantor, that the original owner was also in their chain of title.
But
right?
That's why it's just a presumption. And it's a presumption of the center line, because the current deeds of the plaintiffs don't have it. I mean, that's really, I think, isn't that what Justice Coase is getting at? Their deeds don't show, right? So you make the presumption.
No, Your Honor. It's not just that their deeds don't show. It's that we don't even have any evidence that the original owner of the highway was in their chain of title as is a prerequisite to invoking the rule in the first place. If you can show that the original owner was in your chain of title, you can invoke the presumption that that person intended to convey their interest in the right-of-way up to the center line to the next person in the chain, to the next person in the chain, to the next person in the chain, unless somewhere along there we can show there was an express reservation of that interest, right? But you just don't get to come in to court and say, merely because I put a deed into the record that says I have adjacent property, I own half. That's not how it works. You have to put your chain of title in order to invoke the rule in the first place. And then once you've invoked the rule, it's our burden to show why on the face of those deeds there was an express reservation of the railway property. And again, so as I was going to say, this is not a heavy burden. The plaintiffs in a written pleading to the Court of Federal Claims stated that they could produce the relevant chains of title in just a few months' time. So this is not some heavy burden we're asking the plaintiffs to have to perform. They're able to put those chains of title into the record.
Often there'll be a common grantor, I would assume.
Often there may be, or there may not be. That's what we're hoping to discover by having in front of the court the chains of title. And this court should not countenance a rule that would allow the plaintiffs to withhold evidence that they can be and should be expected to have, especially where the consequence could be to take property from the person on one side of the right-of-way and give it to another, merely because the defendant is unable to produce the plaintiff's chain of title. That's an awfully odd rule when the usual burdens of proof is that an owner of property is expected to obtain and review their chain of title upon purchasing property, and a plaintiff in an ordinary property dispute has always been required to produce their chain of title.
Tell me, does the U.S. Treasury always bear the burden of this, or is it laid back on the interim trail user political entities?
It's usually, as the law currently stands, the U.S. Treasury has been paying out for Fifth Amendment takings.
For in other words, it's future banking or some kind of...
That's correct. Right. Even though it's the Colorado municipalities of Windsor, Severance, and Eaton that applied for and are managing the area as a recreational trail, the United States ends up paying compensation if a Fifth Amendment taking has occurred.
Yeah, for that perpetual interest in that line. Very, very wise policy, sounds like.
Well, that's, one could debate the policy, but I'd like to also point Your Honors to a very recent Washington State Supreme Court case that we cited in our brief. This case is Roeder versus Burlington Northern. This case specifically considered the question that Your Honors are confronted with. This notion that the centerline rule is just a straight up evidentiary presumption, and rejected it, and stated specifically that a property owner receives no interest in a railroad right-of-way simply through the ownership of abutting land, but rather they need to produce evidence that they received their property from the fee owner of the right-of-way. So Your Honor asked, what's the lay of the land among the other states? We acknowledge, with respect to the idea that the centerline rule does not apply to railroad rights-of-way, we acknowledge we are asserting the minority position. But with respect to the second question that we're talking about, which is the centerline rule an evidentiary presumption, or is it a rule of construction? And what does the plaintiff need to put into the record in order to invoke that rule? We are in the majority. We cited Roeder versus Burlington Northern, that's the state of Washington, specifically stated that the plaintiff needs to put evidence into the record that they received their property from the fee owner of the right-of-way in order to invoke the presumption. And they cited a very influential Supreme Court case from the Supreme Court of Alabama, that's Standard Oil versus Milner, which has been cited by multiple other state Supreme Court cases, that said essentially that if it were an evidentiary presumption the way the plaintiffs are arguing, that in many cases the practical effect would be to presumptively take property from the landowner on one side of the right-of-way and give it to another, and there's drastic constitutional implications for that position. This court's own case law in Olin and Overland is more consistent with Roeder and Standard Oil, because in both of those instances where this court discussed the common law rule, it specifically stated that for the rule to apply, the grantor must own fee title to the right-of-way. And what we're arguing here is that because the traditional burdens of proof in property disputes place the burden on the plaintiff to produce evidence of the strength of its own title, that the plaintiff should be required to put its own chain of title into the record. I mean, that is not a very heavy burden.
That seems like a threshold idea of participation, you know?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's just a threshold question that the plaintiffs need to meet, and then we can examine the deeds that were put into the record, and if there's no express reservation on the face of those deeds, then they enjoy the benefits of the presumption. You know, I think I've covered most of the points that I had to state here this morning. One thing I would bring up is that the plaintiffs are repeatedly stating that this court has countenanced this strip and gore doctrine. They say that this court adopted that policy in Morrissey. I'd just like to point out that the plaintiffs are repeatedly quoting from the dissent in that case. The dissent in that case discussed the strip and gore doctrine, not the majority opinion. The majority opinion in that case stated, as we discussed in our brief, stated the rule, but we believe that it was referring to a statutory rule that was in effect in the time, not the common law rule. The common law rule is stated in Olin and Overland and specifically states that the grantor must own fee title in order for the rule to apply. I'd also encourage Your Honors, you had some questions about what we stipulated to in this case. We did not stipulate as to who owns the right-of-way property. We absolutely did not stipulate to that. That's precisely the question that we've been litigating. And I would urge Your Honors to take a look at documents number 34 and number 37 that we placed into the record before this court by attaching them to our brief as an addendum. Those two documents contain the only stipulations in this case, and you'll see very clearly that we did not stipulate to those.
Okay, so you did not stipulate that these claimants have fee title.
Absolutely
to the
not.
Land
that,
underneath.
That is precisely what we will.
That was just a misassertion.
That's correct.
That counsel's going to clear up when she stands up here, right?
I sure hope so. Yes, because if you look at documents number 34 and 37, they specifically state that we did not stipulate as to who owns the right-of-way property. I'd also urge Your Honors to take a look at docket number 81, where the plaintiff specifically stated that they could produce these chains of title in just a few months' time. It's awfully confusing to me why we're having such a heated debate over who has the burden to produce these chains of title when they're already in the plaintiff's possession, apparently. So unless Your Honors have any further questions, I yield the 18 seconds remaining of my time.
Thank you. Rebuttal, Ms. McCoy?
May it please the court. Let me just clear up for Your Honor. We have stipulated that these landowners own land adjacent to the railroad right-of-way. That's exactly what we've stipulated to.
Okay, but there's no stipulation that they own the fee title.
That's why we're here, because Judge Warren said the centerline presumption, we need to get guidance on that from the Colorado Supreme Court. And so if you hold that the centerline presumption applies, then the burden on, then it's assumed that and presumed that each landowner owns to the centerline of the railroad right-of-way, and the defendant can rebut that. All of the plaintiff's deeds, our ownership deeds, are in the record, and all of the original railroad right-of-way deeds are in the record. So when the courts talk about, the Supreme Court talks about the centerline presumption, and it says if the owner of the underlying fee owns that much or whatever, what they're talking about is the centerline presumption is presumed unless it's rebutted, and so that's the whole basis for the centerline presumption.
What about the Rader case? I mean, I think
Roeder. Let me.
Roeder.
I'm very familiar with the Roeder case, Your Honor. Roeder, the defendant kind of took some language out of context and took a quote out of context. Roeder involved many different plaintiffs.
Right.
And the Davis plaintiffs specifically did not put their warranty deed into evidence. And the court held the centerline presumption applied under Washington law except for the Davis plaintiffs because they did not provide a warranty deed where they could see if there was some kind of an exception under Washington law that would exclude that railroad right-of-way. So that's absolutely not what the Roeder court held. The Roeder court applied the centerline presumption under Washington law. As far as...
Let me get this straight because I don't understand it. I'm reading about the Davis case. The presumption that the grantor intended to convey title to the center of the right-of-way is inapplicable where the adjoining landowner presents no evidence of having received his or her property from the owner of the right-of-way.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the beginning of that case, you'll see when they went through the case and talked about the proof. And what proof was put into the record, they note that Davis has never presented any proof of their ownership. They just said, we own land adjacent to the railroad right-of-way. And so here, we don't have that. In this case, all of our landowners have presented their deeds of ownership, and the government has stipulated that these landowners own land adjacent to the railroad right-of-way.
I don't understand. It says here that Davis's claim is based solely on their ownership of abutting property.
Right. They came in and said we own land adjacent to a railroad right-of-way, like if they produce a parcel map or something like that. But they don't. I think in the very beginning of the opinion, you'll see that they did not produce the deed showing how they got their land. And of course, under the
wait a minute. It says neither the location of the Davis's property nor the deeds through which they acquired their property.
Yes, Your Honor. See, that's the difference. That's why the Roeder court held that, because they said Davis's didn't produce any kind of warranty deed, and the defendant often cites and misquotes Roeder, which is continually rejected. These plaintiffs, this is not a windfall. This is a Fifth Amendment takings case. These landowners have a constitutional right to compensation for the taking of their land. And the federal government, our Congress, enacted a statute. And it's a good statute. It's a statute that helps preserve railroad rights of way. They did network way back when. They didn't want to let go of the network of rights of way. And so they decided to preserve them. And that's fine for, you know, recreational trails. But these landowners who own that land deserve the compensation for the taking of their land.
Okay, how do we take account of avoiding a double payment? You know, the owner on the other side comes up with a deed, in fact, owns all of it.
That is an issue that would be decided later. It's a factual issue after the defendant's liability. If that's that would be rebuttal evidence.
No.
As to the centerline presumption.
But do the property owners have to come in at some time and make their claim or be barred?
They already have. All these property owners have asserted their claim in the Court of Federal Claims for the taking of their land. And by the way, they don't provide notice to landowners that they're taking their land. They just issue a need to. And the property owners, they publish it on the Surface and Transportation website, and we typically find the need tos.
Wow.
Yeah, they don't tell them. And then they have to bring an inverse condemnation type action because a lot of times, sometimes the government stipulates that there are easements like they have here, because under Colorado law, this is clearly an
inverse. So you represent landowners in this case that are up and down both sides of the right-of-way?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And there are, like I said, 85 to 90% of the landowners asserted their claim for just compensation under the Trails Act. And, you know, again, property rights are really important. Think about the Iowa farmers and the Weld County farmers. You know, they have a railroad going right through the middle of their farm, which, you know, reduces production and stuff. Of course they would like their land back, but the federal government enacted the Trails Act, and so they can't have their land back. So this is the only remedy they have, is just compensation. And to accept the defendant's position that we have to produce chains of title, that's not the burden here. The Federal Circuit Directive says the first question is, who owns the land? Specifically, did the railroad own an easement? This is not a title dispute between two landowners. We don't have the burden of proof like a title dispute. If there are title disputes later, then so be it. We could have the, you know, the present rebuttal evidence to the centerline presumption. The defendant is simply trying to undo hundreds of years of property law, common law development, to promote efficient ownership of property and honor the grantor's most likely intent. This will litigation will ensue because landowners will have to have a higher burden than is really what should be required. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank both attorneys for their arguments. The case will be submitted on the briefs.